Today I'm going to talk to you about this book, and there is a picture here, so it helps explain it. But let me say that it's called Outsourcing Sovereignty for, it sort of gives it away, because the concern I have is with the problem of government contracting out important functions to private contractors that should indeed be done by government itself. And the hope is that we are now at a point where we can rethink some of these devolutions to the private sector of important functions of government. The picture on the front obviously is meant to be provocative. It is private contractors in Iraq receiving their payment, which comes in the form of stacks of $100 bills. When the encounter in Iraq began, the New York Fed shipped over $6 billion in pallets of $100 bills to Iraq for Paul Bremer to administer. Of course, that money is hard to locate and what happened to it. We do know it was spent.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is Paul Verkile. Paul Verkile is the author of Outsourcing Sovereignty, Why Privatization of Government Functions Threatens Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Paul Verkile has had a very distinguished career as a lawyer. He prepared for the study of law at the College of William and Mary, where, of course, the founder of this university studied law. And then he earned his law degree here at the University of Virginia. He was in the same class with our director, Governor Jerry Beliles, actually the year ahead of me. And so Paul and I knew each other slightly. He was a whole year ahead of me, so older person. He holds master's degrees from NYU and the New School for Social Research, and he holds the JSD degree from NYU. He served as president of the College of William and Mary, as well as dean of the Tulane Law School and of the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University. He was selected by the U.S. Supreme Court to act as a special master in the 1998 dispute between New York and New Jersey over the sovereignty of Ellis Island. Paul Verkile is the author or the co-author of what are now recognized as the standard works on administrative law and process and on regulation and deregulation. Please join me in welcoming Paul Verkile.
Thanks a lot, George. Thank you. It's very nice to see you again and to be here in my old school grounds. I think the nicest thing in the world is to have a William and Mary College degree and a UVA law degree. I recommend it to anyone. It's a nice combination. We get Mr. Jefferson in his full scope, and that's quite a story there. Today I'm going to talk to you about this book, and there is a picture here, so it helps explain it. But let me say that it's called Outsourcing Sovereignty for, it sort of gives it away, because the concern I have is with the problem of government contracting out important functions to private contractors that should indeed be done by government itself. And the hope is that we are now at a point where we can rethink some of these devolutions to the private sector of important functions of government. The picture on the front obviously is meant to be provocative. It is private contractors in Iraq receiving their payment, which comes in the form of stacks of $100 bills. When the encounter in Iraq began, the New York Fed shipped over $6 billion in pallets of $100 bills to Iraq for Paul Bremer to administer. Of course, that money it's hard to locate and what happened to it. We do know it was spent. And so that's one of the concerns, which is an accountability concern as well, that I would like to address. But the real concern is whether or not we should be drawing a limit and drawing a line upon those kinds of functions that private sector can perform on behalf of government. The title that I like to refer to in subtitles, at least, in one of the chapters, it's called The Duty to Govern. The Duty to Govern. Whether or not in our society there are some functions that have to be performed by government. Recently, Leslie Green, an eminent Oxford legal philosopher, wrote an article called The Duty to Govern, where he cited my work, and I was very pleased by that, because he says, and I think it helps me appreciate, and maybe helps me communicate to you, the difficulty of adding the duty to government to what we normally think of as the responsibilities of government. There are two major responsibilities. One is the right to govern, whether or not the government is legitimate. And that is, of course, a political question. We think in a democratic society, right, that government has achieved the right to govern, and it's subjected to the will of the people. And then there's the duty to obey, which is really by the governed. And we accept that duty or that obligation because we are generally believed to be, as we were handed, a liberal democratic state wherein the people have choices and they therefore owe obedience. But the duty to govern itself, what the government must do, is not very well articulated by legal philosophy. And Leslie Green's proposition is that we ought to now turn to that, especially in this era of heightened contracting out. I base my argument on the Constitution and several basic propositions. I won't go into great detail, but the first is the Take Care Clause. There is a clause in Article 2 where the executive has to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And the Take Care Clause, it seems to me, implies an obligation and a trust on the executive branch to execute those duties, if not personally, certainly through the use of officials of government. And so that's one proposition. And the second is the Appointments Clause, where the president is given authority to appoint, with the advice and consent of the Senate, officers of the United States. Those are the people, the significant people in government, who actually perform the work that government has to do. And officers of the United States, under the Buckley versus Vallejo case, must be defined as those who exercise significant authority on behalf of the government, significant authority. And it's hard to know always what that is, but significant authority is certainly that authority which is discretionary, which is exercise of government responsibility in an important way. And so it's that connection which makes me think that the duty to govern is really implicit in our constitutional structure. Now, what has happened in recent years has been a massive devolution of power to private sector, to contractors, for a variety of reasons, some of them very sensible. I mean, I've been following this. I teach in the field of administrative law and regulation for now many years, and it starts, I think, the Reagan administration, the Reagan Revolution, the idea that the government was just not doing what it should be doing or doing too much, the idea that you could streamline government, that you could downsize government. The Clinton administration came along and reinforced this with a reinventing government concept. And by the time we've gotten to the current standard, we have cut back on the size of government dramatically, on the civilian size of government. And we've deregulated, we've done some very good things. We've taken government out of some roles that it didn't really need to be in and let the private sector flourish. That's just fine. On the other hand, it also, by limiting the size of government, has made it harder for government to do the jobs it must do. And so what we have now in the last 8 years of the Bush administration is this tendency to pick contractors to do more and more work of government because there simply aren't enough government officials available to do the job. My examples, of course, are in two sectors. The most compelling probably is the use of private security contractors. And I think I should talk a few minutes about that, and then I'd like to talk about the civilian sector as well. Private security contractors are characterized by the Blackwater company. I'm sure these terms are familiar to you. Blackwater is a company that does operate mostly for the State Department and for Bremer when he was running the coalition to protect the State Department and Bremer in a war zone area. And Blackwater has had several incidents in the last few years, one of which came out after my book came out, which made it a very sort of great opportunity to emphasize the point where in Baghdad, the Blackwater employees entered into an intersection and seeing what they thought was a car coming at them with potentially a terrorist, started opening fire and killed 17 people, mostly Iraqis, in fact, all Iraqis. And the FBI investigated that and found that these were unjustified shootings. So that you have a government contractor doing the work, really, of the military in this situation. Now, the Blackwater folks are very well trained. A lot of them are ex-special forces, ex-SEALs. They've had good military training. But they are on their own and basically without any oversight. And their job is to protect, let's say, members of the State Department who are going on a particular mission, and not more or less to do the more general thing, which is to protect and give you a sense of general assimilation of people that the military has to sort of bring peace to the area or try and reduce the amount of tension. So that is a major incident. There were several others. There is one famous one at Fallujah where four of the Blackwater troops were actually in a horrible way hung up and dismembered and they were killed. And it forced us to go into Fallujah to recover and to force the Marines to go in. So they've had a pretty active role. Now, from my point of view, and in the book I make efforts to say that these are the kind of roles that the Blackwater is playing, which should be played by the military. These aren't people who are simply assisting the military. These aren't people who are, you know, providing logistical services or people who are providing food service or something like that. These are people who are actually providing what I would call warfighting services, what was defined as warfighting services. And those are inherently military. That's the exercise of significant authority to take you back to the Constitution. That's something that under the Constitution, officers of the United States should be in charge of, not private contractors. Now, it's very hard to stop this because there's a bill in the Senate now to eliminate the use of private security contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan, but there's a problem with implementing it. And there's also this tension between what we can do and what we should do. Blackwater itself, interestingly, they've been sued, by the way, as a result of the Fallujah incident, the survivors of the four men who were killed have sued Blackwater in court in D.C., actually, and they've tried to move it to Virginia. So it's in our neighborhood. This lawsuit, interestingly, one of the defenses Blackwater makes is that they are doing what they call classic military functions. They say themselves they're doing classic military functions. And they say that under separation of powers, they deserve the same deference that the military would get for doing the same thing. They actually make the argument, from my point of view, exactly the one I'm making, in their defense to a suit for liability against people who were killed, against their employees who were killed. Now, they so far have succeeded. At least they've avoided liability in the courts. They've avoided criminal liability for these unjustified killings. And they have avoided contractual liability because they are still getting contracts, and they're getting, in fact, larger and increasing contracts. And by the way,
it just recently came out that they don't, the people who work for Blackwater aren't employees. I really misspoke when I said that. They're independent contractors. They don't pay taxes on them. They don't want to withhold for them. So now you have the almost a double paradox, because you've got Blackwater itself saying they aren't even our employees. They are independent contractors. So the government is contracting with a private contractor who doesn't even hire employees, but hires himself, itself, other contractors. And that's the relationship. And that creates a tension because it exacerbates the accountability problem. If you don't have an employee, any of you in private business know, you have very limited ways in which you can oversee that. Indeed, if you started to oversee an independent contractor, they would become an employee. So they're caught in a way by their tax filings, which is part of this whole thing. And for me, more importantly, it just highlights how wrong this is, that we should be giving these jobs to people. And they're not that they're not good. I mean, there are a lot of them are very good, and they're military. You know, if they're special forces, they've had 8 or 10 years of training that the military has given them. And now they go out, they get a much larger salary for them, and they're in the private sector. But they're very, you know, by definition, very good people. We can't find a good way to replace them, and that is one of the obstacles. That's why the Senate bill I mentioned may not work. It's just going to be very hard for the military, which is so short-handed now, as you may be following. It's so hard for them to get to fill the roles of recruits. And you can't turn out a special forces. A special ops person takes 6 to 8 years to create. So you just can't walk into the market and provide the one, you know, replace them very readily. But still, the question is whether we should do it and whether we might have to do it at some point. So that's the military side of the equation. But there's also a concern on the civilian side, and perhaps more importantly on the civilian side. Let me just give you some examples. Take the EPA, the Environmental Protection Administration. When it writes a rule or a regulation, in these days, it contracts out responsibilities for doing so. So that it may contract out even the drafting of the rule. It certainly contracts out reading all the comments that come in with respect to the rule. And they're summarized, and then it contracts out maybe the drafting of the final rule. In fact, there's evidence that what the assistant secretary at EPA gets is, a package done by the contractor which contains most of the information and the rationale for the rule. And all they have to do is sign off on it, rubber stamp it, really, and put it out. In these situations, in other words, contractors have come to the point where they are beginning to do much of the thinking, the intellectual work of government, and that the government official is, you know, who of course hires the contractor, is left only to make the final sort of formality decision, but really hasn't done the analysis necessarily, which is what you want, I think, we all want. We want government at the highest level. When we're dealing with environmental concerns, climate change issues, very overarching issues of our future, to be done by people who really are actually performing the work themselves, our public officials. And that has gone on increasingly. So what has been the cause of this? Well, one of the causes is this downsizing, where we're too small as a government at the higher levels, the sort of the top levels of government, where the intellectual capacity is in short supply. You know, we're not talking about contracting out, you know, the people who, let's say, would cut the lawn at the White House, okay? That's fine, and we should all, those of you who are in business know that, you know, in business you decide whether you make it yourself or whether you buy it. And that's a normal function even government can share in. There are some functions that government doesn't have to perform. They're not critical or inherent. But the intellectual part of government, the thinking it out, the preparing arguments and defending them and taking policy positions should be the work of government officials. And increasingly, it's the work of contractors, at least the intellectual part, and where government officials will buy in. But they won't be part of the process as they should be. Now, this means that we get a government that is more contractor-driven. And as you might expect, what you see is, especially as we've added to the number of political appointees in government, and this has happened in the years since Reagan and Clinton, the number of political appointees has grown from maybe 1,000 to over 3,000. And every time you have a political appointee, of course, you create someone, obviously, which is good. We want people to be responsible to the president. The president has the duty to take care, and the president needs political appointees and also needs civil servants to work. But whenever you have a political appointee, you have a natural inclination to contract out, because many of these political appointees come from the very contracting shops that they hire. And there's a difficulty there. I think there's an oversight difficulty and a likely conflict of interest, which is not attended to either. And so it's a force that builds on itself. Contractors become, they get hired, they go back out into the contracting world, they come back in and they go into government and they perpetuate themselves, and the growth of the famous K Street is part of all of this situation. So from my point of view, I would say, first of all, let's not do some of these jobs in the private sector. Let's draw careful lines based on constitutional analysis that would support it. That's point one. But if we do, and we have to, and in some cases we can't just turn it around overnight, then we have to have more accountability and more transparency. We have to know what these contracts say. We want competitive bidding. We want to be able to give, before you award a contract, you want to have more than one person, you know, hopefully applying for it. That's itself a kind of has a market discipline to it. We want to have limited terms. We want to have oversight. We have enormous short supply of contracting officers. Contracting officers in government are crucial in this area because we are in a situation where they need to oversee oftentimes now, no-bid, single-sourced contracts with very little explanation of what the duties are. And so it's imperative that we have some oversight from government. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude of this, the Defense Department has about $400 billion a year in contracts and awards. Of that $400 billion, of course, a lot of it goes to equipment, right? But 60% is now for services, all-in services. And a lot of that is contractor services. So this is a growing share of the federal budget. This is not something that has just come on us anytime soon. It's been growing, as I say. So there's a profound effect, and there's an investment, really. In the contractor community, there's also the public choice dimensions of, you know, contractors themselves have influence. If you take the 10 largest government contractors, then you take the 10 largest contributors to the parties in office, and you will see almost an exact relationship. So it's not, you know, that's the way the world is. We wouldn't even be shocked by that. You would be surprised, if it weren't the case. But it does mean that you get this difficulty and this conflict of interest. I would give you, I think, some signs of hope. The fact that there's a bill in now, at least with respect to these private security contractors like Blackwater, is a significant step. That there's more of an awareness. The likelihood that we're going to come into a new administration with the notion that we have to restore government as opposed to constantly impugning it or using it as a tool for ridicule even is I think very powerful now. I think there's more of a sense that government has a job to do, that we need good people in government, we got to encourage people. And once we do that, and once we're willing to hire people and keep them in the civil service, in the career branch of government, we are likely to be much better off, including I would hope, much better off because we'll take people from good places like this and other universities where we can really do some, make some important decisions together. So that's the basic proposition, George, and I'm happy to give it to you more or in more detail or let you give me some questions.
Paul, there are lots. I'm going to move to the back of the room here in just a minute, and I would invite those who have questions, and judging by the way people were nodding their head, I expect that there will be some good questions. Invite them to join me in the back of the room here, and we should have about 25 minutes that we can take questions. There are lots of little nuggets in this book, and one that particularly struck me was the statement that private military contractors provide about 20,000 people to the troops in Iraq. And the 20,000 that are supplied by private military contractors are larger than the forces that all the other members of the so-called Coalition of the Willing combined have contributed. So the scope of this practice is enormous. One thing I didn't see was whether or not there are comparable numbers for the number of people who are providing domestic outsourced governmental services, whether there's any way to estimate the number of people who do that. And then secondly, is there a distinction, is there a legal distinction between our ability to exercise control over those who are working on domestic soil and those who are working on foreign soil?
Well, those are two good questions. Let me just first say that we do have an ability to recover against contractors who don't do their jobs domestically much more readily than overseas. Right now there's a lack of jurisdiction. There is some legislation that could potentially apply. The Justice Department has not done it yet, two contractors. But the contractors, let's say in Iraq, who participated in the killings in Baghdad in this intersection, these 17 deads, they were just sent home. I mean, what Blackwater says is, look, you go home without your bonus. That's your penalty. There's been no criminal charges leveled, and it may be there's some gaps in the criminal law right now, which the Congress is trying to fill, but there's been no criminal charges leveled. There are likely not to be any civil charges leveled. And, of course, there's a status of forces agreement with the Iraqi government where they have immunity from suit, that the Iraqis can't sue or penalize any contractors. And you could understand that, obviously. I don't think any of us probably feels that at the time the Iraqi government was in a situation where it could appropriately bring cases against people, but maybe they are or will become soon, as some of our other, you know, we're in other countries like Germany and Japan, we have status of forces agreements where the country can, in fact, charge people if they've committed a crime. But so that's the gap there. Number of contractors in the civilian sector is a hard number to come up with. I don't think anyone has an answer. I did find one amazing statistic, though, and that is security clearances. There are approximately 1.7 million civilian workers in government, okay? I'm not counting the post office, which has its just large contingent, but leave the post office aside, about 1.7. There are, among contractors, 800,000 security clearances. So that if you add, that's a minimum number. That's only those who are, after all, important enough to have a security clearance. 800,000 contractors is half the size of the total civilian workforce who have security clearances. I'm sure it's more than our government employees, not civilian employees who have security clearances. So that gives you some idea of the magnitude. And you know, agencies like Department of Energy, Of course, NASA and others have large numbers, and our favorite agency, which is the one that's under Homeland Security, which is the one that was created as a result of 9/11, has a very heavy use of contractors. So it's a big number, George. It may almost be as big as the size of the civilian workforce.
With the complexity and sophistication of technology these days, I wonder how many of the services that are provided by these contractors are so complex and sophisticated that it may be very difficult to find unbiased people who could serve in an oversight capacity, and you are keeping them in the military, keeping them in the government would be a very difficult process. I can wonder, in a way, whether you're going to find a whole cadre of people who can do this sort of function for you.
You mean oversight function?
Oversight function.
It's a problem. I mean, what has happened is that the talent level probably has been reduced in government, in the permanent government. And it is certainly true. I mean, we did the NASA project, right? Had to be done with a lot of private people because we don't have the talent, the scientific talent, to go into outer space just through government services. So you do need, obviously, people in that kind of a role. But I think the answer to whether we have people who are adequate to oversee, it has to answer itself. If we can't oversee, then we can't do this. You know, it doesn't seem to me possible that we should be in a situation where we're employing contractors and we can't even evaluate whether they're doing a good job or not. We almost have to find those capacities. Otherwise, we're the citizens who are paying for all of this, and it seemed to me are being cheated. So that it is a problem and a challenge, but it's one that we have to meet, I think. We have to get qualified people as contracting officers and overseers and evaluators of performance.
I'd be curious to know to what extent these contractors are foreign corporations, foreign entities. And then the other question I would have, even if they are domestic, are some of their, which I guess we would call subcontractors, foreign nationals?
I'm sure that the subcontractors are. In general, the contracting officers or the people who contract with government have to be qualified in the U.S., either, you know, U.S.-based or not. For example, Blackwater can't work for anybody but the United States. It's obviously a United States entity and has you know, done some very good things in its training mission in the States. So, but there may be subcontractors who are not U.S., and there's certainly non-U.S. nationals working in the security field. The security field actually started years ago with people, you know, the South Africans came in, and there were, Chile provides a lot of, there have been a lot of different other nationals that are providing services, not just U.S.
Are any of the presidential candidates addressing these issues at this point? Has anybody talked about the devolution, or the success of the starve the beast philosophy and what it has led to?
Right.
Has anybody challenged Bill Clinton's assertion that the era of big government is over and suggested
right.
that maybe we need to grow government a little bit?
You know, George, it's such a hard proposition for the politicians to take on because they have to be saying, look, we need more investment in government, which, you know, we need a bigger government. No one wants to say that. So it's, as you say, the era of big government is over. It was a nice thing to say, but the era of smart and restoring government is coming is a harder thing to say. I don't think it's impossible. The Senate bill is one indicator. Now, just so happens, Senator Clinton signed on to that bill, and Senator Obama was opposed to it. Essentially, I'm not sure about Senator McCain, but so there is, you know, they're willing to take on some of these issues. I think we need to get a nonpartisan approach to this, though. We have to say that it's time to restore government, to get very talented people back in government, because the problems that we're facing, you know, it aren't just international, not just Iraq and Afghanistan and the the problems of terrorism, which are going to go on, I assume, for a long time. But it's also climate change and global warming and these overarching issues that require us to deal with other countries and that require good science and good understanding, so that if we could get the candidates to realize that this is a time to help us build a, you know, not a overpowering government, but just one where the talented people can be back in and encouraged to serve. They're not encouraged to serve.
I have two questions. Is there any way of establishing the cost of hiring 20,000 security personnel versus the use of the military for these tasks?
The Department of Defense estimates that to put 10,000 soldiers out would cost $10 billion a year. So if you had 20,000, it's like a $20 billion. Now, you know, on a $400 billion budget, that's 5%. So that's one answer. That's the DOD has evaluated this. The more complicated answer, though, is that you can't replace special forces, special ops people who had 10 to 12 years training overnight, and you can't build it up. So that's the harder job, and the cost of that has not been calculated. The fact that they pay 2 to 3 times the salary that, you know, you could get in the military when you're a private contractor doesn't necessarily mean it's not cost efficient, because you don't have all the overhead, you don't have the retirement, you know, you have less responsibilities, the sort of hidden costs. However, from our point of view, we just need the talented people in there to begin with, and maybe if we didn't, the irony is, of course, that we've created a market. We've created a market for private contractors to leave the military, take twice their salary. Huh? We've generated the market. If we stopped generating the market, they might not leave, and so we wouldn't be losing them, and we wouldn't have to replace them. That part is harder to calculate, but it's certainly a part of the picture, isn't it? Yeah.
In your book, do you deal with the prison system in the United States?
I do.
2 million people behind bars.
2.4.
What is the percentage of state and federal employees in the prison system as opposed to contractors out?
The prison systems at both federal and state level have been privatized to some degree. It's approximately 5% of the prisoners are under the control of prison companies. So, whatever that is, that's 10% is, it's about 100,000 more. And that moves a little bit, 5 or 6%. But let me just take a moment, because it's an important distinction. Private prisons are awarded, contractors, there's WAC and HUD, these are stock exchange traded companies, okay? They run prisons, they even build prisons, and they guard prisons. And there's a lot of concern about whether they're doing a good job. The evidence is pretty good on them. Let's say, prisoner abuse, if you compare public versus private, there are no real differences. But the good thing about that is that these contracts are awarded after competitive bidding by states primarily, right? And they are carefully drawn with standards with respect to how you treat prisoners and everything else. And they have to meet, and they have to be more efficient. They have to cost less. And they can get renewed or not renewed, so that the oversight is much better, it's much more transparent. And so even though you do have, and what I think is a government function, ultimately, that is to say incarcerating people, and is nonetheless done in a much better fashion by the prisoners. It's my sense of it.
Thank you very much for your comments earlier in this session. I had a very interesting thing happen to me about 3 hours ago. A neighbor of mine and I were out playing golf at Glenmore, and we waved on this young person behind us playing singly. And he approached us, and he said, "Hi, my name is so-and-so, and I'm the new assistant golf pro here." I said, "Hi." And I said, "Where are you coming from?" He says, "I was in the Navy, but I've left the Navy, and I'm here now." This gentleman was a first-class petty officer, a submarine sonarman, working in Puget Sound Naval Shipyard for a government contractor, of course. He was in the Seaman to Admiral program. He had to go to sea, so he wanted to come to either Norfolk or Connecticut to go to sea, and he was denied. Meanwhile, this government contractor was offering him three times what he was making in the Navy. Now he's playing golf at Glenmore and making three times what he's making. And this happens again and again and again. I was in the Navy for 20 years. I saw this happen all the time. But
and you didn't
I think
play
these,
golf.
These are the market forces at work.
No, I know.
What can we do? This is the market forces that our democracy guarantees for us. Meanwhile, you say we need a bigger government to take care of what the government should take care of. How do we develop a bigger government? People don't want to be in government. There's got to be the patriotism, perhaps, or something. To paraphrase a former president, if you want a government big enough to give you everything you want, you very well may have a government that takes everything you have.
Well, but that's always the concern. I mean, you're expressing this is the paradox, really. But let me just say this, because your point is very helpful in a way. If we're going to get it not just so much a bigger government, a better and smarter government, we're going to have to be saying to ourselves that we don't count the cost of contractors, okay? When we say what is the cost of government, we just count heads. We have this foolish notion that it's the head count that really matters. No one says to you, how many contractors have you hired when you're an agency? They don't care. They just care how many people you've got on, how many billets you've got, and if you're in the military. So what we need to do is think through carefully through which of those jobs we're contracting out are better served, because we need the capacity, the redundancy even, and the intelligence and the qualities in-house in government to sustain us. And that's when we have to make some choices to come in-house, not to change the size, the total size of government, because it's the same. It's just, and by the way, does it matter whether you've taken an oath? Yeah, I took an oath. I always thought I was different when I was a first lieutenant than I, So I do think the oath matters and the badge matters. I do think people who serve in government believe they have a special mission, and I think it is under our Constitution to protect and defend. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's hard for a contractor to create those incentives. The contractor obviously is worried about the competitive package, right? We have to confront that too. We have to give them the psychic income. Give people in government some psychic income. We've been depriving them of it in a lot of ways because we haven't given them enough credit. If we can restore some of that, and if the next administration can do that, and I think it's a priority that it does that, we can be in better shape.
You started your talk talking about accountability, and I'm wondering whether or not there's been, what kind of studies or investigations have gone into accountability, so that we know that the money's going where it's supposed to go. Have these kinds of things taken place, and if so, what are the results?
There's one wonderful agency of government called the General Accountability Office, GAO, if anyone's familiar with it, right? This is the agency. It works for Congress. And any member, by the way, majority or minority, can call GAO to do a study. GAO does wonderful studies. It does point out a lot of these deficiencies. Recently, it did one on Homeland Security, which I'm very familiar with. I've used it in my work, where it said, look, the Homeland Security is contracting out important functions of government, inherent functions of government. It's not giving enough care to this thing, and it demonstrates it. GAO is a small agency, however. It's 3,000 people. It can't do enough by itself, but it is crucially important. It as one agency of government that helps us reach through to these problems. We just need more people in government agencies, in the inspector general's roles and other things, can provide the kind of service you need.
Thank you for your talk. I understand why you think private contracting is a dereliction of sovereign duty and therefore it should be taken back in a way. I wonder, though, if you thought a little bit about a different but related issue, that is the issue of private companies, private security companies working for international organizations. And I think there are different legal, political, and moral issues involved. And I'm thinking particularly at one example. That is the example of where early on during the Rwandan genocide, a private military company went to the UN and offered to stop the genocide, you know, for low cost. At a point where nobody else in the world was willing to intervene, and the UN itself labeled the genocide as a civil war and therefore refused to send any kind of help to the people who were victims. So do you think in that case, you know, in the case of international organization where we have a more fluid conception of sovereignty, do you think that's an acceptable case where private military companies could play a role and possibly a very positive one?
Yeah, I mean, my argument is based on the United States and the United States Constitution and our traditions. When you get to the UN, it's a much more complicated world. And it may be, it may be that the only way to get action at all is through some kind of use of contractors, just because you can't get the countries to agree to put the soldiers in there at the right time. It's a different equation for me. I can see a difference, yes.
Thank you very much for your talk. What do you see as the threat of having a parallel between the corporate donors to campaigns and the same type of people who are the contractors for major government agencies?
Well, this has always been with us, this concern. You remember Dwight Eisenhower in his last address talked about the military-industrial complex, and what he was talking about was the concern that, in effect, policy would be made by those outside of government because they had such control over funding. Well, when he was talking about it, it was just for military equipment. Now it's services. So it's a much more profound problem. We can't make that go away. I mean, this is, you know, if you believe in public choice theory, which to some degree we all have to recognize that there's an inevitability here when there's a desire on one side to promote something, you've got to be very alert to it, but the market will move you, even a political market will move you forward. I would just say that today we have contracted out things that we don't have to contract out and shouldn't, and if we could draw that line, things would rebalance themselves a little better. We're building, Lockheed has the contract to do the Mexican border fence and to do all the security. Now, usually, there again, this is the Border Patrol and this is Homeland Security. Many of the big jobs are going out to contractors. And so Lockheed, which is known as a producer of airplanes, jet, right, is now becoming a major player because they all saw the advantage to move in the direction of services as opposed to just equipment. So it's a much bigger problem than it was for President Eisenhower, if you will.
Well, this may be a related question. How would you compare the services rendered by Blackwater in the service category with the services of companies such as Halliburton providing services of contracting and building back the infrastructure? How would you compare that?
From my perspective, Halliburton, KBR, the ones who are doing the construction work, putting aside whether they're doing a good job, I'm not giving them a pass on that, but I don't see anything wrong with them doing construction work. There are 180,000 contractors in Iraq, more than there are troops. The only ones I'm concerned about particularly are those who are doing inherent functions such as the military, acting as the military. There are about 30,000 of that 180,000. The rest they should be overseen, and they have to, you know, government contracting rules have to apply. But I don't think we should try and create in the government the capacity to, you know, build roads and to build. No, obviously we'd want to contract out, and these major companies are the natural ones to get the contracts. So Halliburton, in this sense, is not, for me, a target. You know, that's another issue, maybe, is whether they're doing a good job. But then they're doing a job that they should do, that the government can contract out, as opposed to those who are doing military-type functions, which government shouldn't contract out.
Are the statutory guidelines that are presently in place and other ethical guidelines in place sufficient to adequately protect the public against what many perceive to be conflicts of interest between corporate officials who move into government and then move back again? There have been some changes as to what members of Congress can do, how long they have to wait before they can lobby, and I gather there are some guidelines as to what members of the executive branch can do. Could you sort of give us an overview of those and then opine as to whether or not we need changes in order to adequately protect the public?
That's a big assignment, George, but I will say this. I do think, in general, the rules are probably adequate if they're enforced. It is true that the senator from Mississippi resigned so he didn't have to be disqualified from lobbying for 2 years. So that tells you something, right? It tells you that the rules that are coming in must be pretty stringent. But the bigger problem is whether they're enforced. Let me give you one example, which is Department of Homeland Security. When the first secretary, Ridge, and the assistant deputy, Aisa Hutchinson, when they left, they had waivers on the rules against contracting with the agency. They got waivers, and they're back in it again, and they're part, so they're working in the system in a way, which was, you know, fine. I mean, it's legal, but it didn't take the rules and use them as well as they might have, and I do think that's an area where we could be more sensitive. We've got the rules on the books, we just have to have the courage to and the power to enforce them. But I don't think we need more rules. And there's the other side of this, too, is we don't want to have such rules that create such barrier that people won't want to come into government in the first place, right? Because you may not want to spend the rest of your life in government, and you want to be, when you get out, you're going to want to go to a company or business or law firm that has relationships with government, because that's where your experience is. So if you make the rules too stringent, you deter people from coming in. So that's the balance we have to remember. It's part of it.
Paul Verkeil's book, Outsourcing Sovereignty, Why Privatization of Governmental Functions Threatens Democracy and What We Can Do About It, contains not only a really cool picture on the cover, but it also contains nugget after nugget of interesting factoids and strong and persuasive argument. We will be offering this very interesting and important book for sale outside. And in fact, we have cleverly located the bookseller's station so that you cannot conveniently leave the building without passing right in front of it. Please join me in thanking Paul Verkeil. Thank you.